session number 17747, rule 45.
Looking up some odd notebooks the other day, and I find what an acerbic and risk-taking young heretic I must have been. I came across this simply entitled The Idiot's Delight. The Brigadier is dining here tonight. Bring out the uncracked cups, rig up the special light. This was in a disused farmhouse. Find the best marsala for this festivity. We've only 1,000 brigs in British Italy. Across Romagna's hills this misty night, the roar of heavy guns bears witness to the fight. Gurkhas reach the summits, shriek Urdu litany, and cut off German scalps with known frivolity. We are taught to think these brown men's sole delight is when they reach the top to bayonet someone white. But Indians also marry, rejoice nativity, and think of those at home and feel timidity. But let them crawl despite the rain tonight. They love the sound of guns and show no trace of fright. What is this to colonels who drink until they're tight to toast the brigadier who's dining here tonight? But this is the stuff of being shot at dawn, but somehow I managed to keep notebooks.
Did you have objections to this particular brigadier?
Oh, no, no, he was a nice man. It was just the concept that things were sacrificed. Undue emphasis was put on formality, ceremony of obeisance to somebody senior visiting. It all seemed slightly out of place in a working situation, a military working situation. I mean, in my later career in civil service, it would seem quite absurd to throw the whole place into disarray in order to accommodate a visiting permanent secretary, or indeed the brigadier level and visiting assistant secretary. But it's just that I was performing, as most people were performing, but also observing. And I took more pleasure in the observing than the performing, I think. The detachment. I also came across a thing which summarises some of what we were talking about last time. And I've noted that this was part of a simultaneous war diary of my own and a contribution to the regiment's account of the war. I don't know whether it was part of the official war diary or whether I was in parallel trying to do a generalised account of the regimental history, which indeed was later produced. I don't know whether there's anything new in it, because we've been over it, but at last we reached what had been the mythical plain. This is a period at the end of October 44. And found ourselves between the rivers Marecchia and Rubicon in positions which attracted a good deal of enemy shelling, particularly airburst during the first few days. Our RHQ seemed to become the main point of impact, the MPI, of one particular enemy gunnery harassing task, and our suspicions that the shooting might be observed shooting were confirmed when Italians were found using transmitting sets in Sant'Arcangelo village. They were shot. Rain bogged down any large-scale activity during the first few days at Sant'Arcangelo, and supplies had to be brought round via Rimini and Route 9 on account of the flooding of the Marecchia River behind us. At this time, the beginning of October, the Canadian Corps was pushing up on the right towards Cesanatico. On our divisional front, progress was extremely hard towards Savignano and the river Fiumicino. The regiment found itself for the first time without any infantry brigade to support. This was due to a reorganisation resulting from very heavy casualties sustained in the Gothic Line battles. The division, 56th Division, was merged into two brigades instead of the usual three, and we were without any infantry of our own until the 43rd Gurkha Brigade was brought into the division a week later. Our second week at Sant'Arcangelo was very quiet, and the 1st Canadian Division relieved us. on Route 9, which is the main motor road running northwest to southeast across northern Italy. Our own infantry going back to rest in the Macerata area, but not the artillery or the engineers. During this period, our observation posts were deployed in the castle at Sant'Arcangelo and other high buildings, but this observation was not good enough to allow of much firing. The main activity was counter-mortar and counter-battery fire on information provided by Division HQ.
On the counter-mortar, did you have any radar-assisted devices for spotting mortars at that stage?
I'm pretty sure we hadn't. Certainly they never crossed my consciousness. This was something we sort of vaguely heard existed, magical things, but not... I may be wrong, but I don't think it ever crossed our horizon at all. We were fairly basic.
How then did you actually go about locating
mortars? Oh, compass bearings, and what do you call it, sort of rough range finding by relative compass bearings, triangulation.
From what information? From the...
I can't remember who it would be from, but there would be infantry. Well, at that time we hadn't any infantry, so that can't be true.
Yes.
We were on our own. But we would take bearings and telephone bearings from outlying positions. I can't remember the deployment precisely, because this was in a very built-up area.
That would obviously make it very difficult.
How we observed, I don't know. And indeed, where the German mortars were, I don't know. They must have probably been in buildings. One is talking on a very small scale about a sort of Beirut situation rather than a...
Because, I mean, as far as I understand it, when locating enemy guns for counter-battery work, there are two basic methods. One is flash ranging, which would not apply with mortars.
Yes, that's right.
And the other is sound ranging.
That's right.
Which is a matter of using your ears and your judgment, trying to get a sense of direction and distance.
Right. That's right. In the case of mortars, of course, the sound is not huge. It's a thump as the thing takes off. On the other hand, you can actually see the missiles with any luck going upwards.
So could you, I mean, do you know of any cases where mortar bombs were spotted going up?
I don't know whether they were spotted to the point of being able to pinpoint the source, but certainly they could be seen going up and reaching their apex and coming down up to a point. I think it was going up that we were able to see them rather than coming down, partly because we were tending to take cover when they came down, but also because I think they gained speed with
descent,
gravity.
Yes. Presumably then you could actually, if you couldn't actually pinpoint the location of a mortar battery, you could get some idea of the area.
Yes. Oh, yes, yes, that's right. It was an approximate business. That's right. I don't suppose we got particularly near to hitting them back. This would have been normally easier had we had infantry in situ. They would have been, by definition, a bit closer to them than we were.
Yes, they would have been able to send in reports,
which
you could correlate.
Right. Exactly, exactly.
An idea of where the bearings
would cross. Mm. This summary is nearly finished now, but I might as well finish it. Route 9, having been cleared halfway towards Cesena, the regiment was transferred to the left flank, once again in support of 43rd Gurkha Brigade, which was now attached, as by extension we were, to the 10th Indian Division. It was good to renew our association, which we already briefly had with the Gurkhas, and they more than proved their worth in the ensuing advance northwards through the hills towards Forli. All battery commanders and observation posts were deployed for what was a fortnight of battle in conditions of extreme bogginess, with problems of maintenance increased by the destruction of all bridges. As the Gurkhas advanced from hill to hill, OP maintenance, that is, supplies to the observation posts, became an urgent and pressing and difficult matter, and all forward parties had to be organised on a mule or man-pack basis. It was fairly basic. The brilliant Gurkha tactics ensured a fairly rapid advance, but the regiment was unable to move beyond Borello village until bridges had been built for the guns. And for the first time in its history, we were in the exasperating position of watching its infantry move out of range of artillery support. Fortunately, the enemy decided to pull back to the line of the Ronco River, and before the lack of artillery support for our infantry could hamper their operations, the regiment was once again on the move to a hill village called Bertinoro, which I think is south of Forlimpopoli. It's in the last range of hills before the plain. At this stage, the 2nd 8th Gurkha Battalion formed a bridgehead over the Ronco, south of Route 9, and 254 Battery's observation post did good work in helping to beat off enemy counterattacks, presumably by the intelligence they were able to pass to the Gurkhas. The gun positions were in a valley forward of Bertinoro, and occupation was difficult owing to road conditions and enemy observation. The village itself, situated on the last ridge before the Po Plain, provided an excellent grandstand view of the operations on Forley Airfield and beyond. In this position, 46th Division relieved 10th Indian when a firm crossing had been established opposite La Frata, and for the second time we bade farewell to our Gurkha friends. The regiment concentrated for a few days' rest in Bertinoro, but this was rudely interrupted by a call to join 4th British Division's artillery on the plain for a direct assault on Forley itself.
So you were being moved around from one formation to another.
Yes. That is Concord, 11 o'clock.
You mentioned using manpack to resupply. What sort of weight could a man carry in those conditions?
I can't think of it in terms of a man pack of provisions, but I can, by analogy with the radio sets, the 11 and 21 sets, which were regularly carried whenever we had to walk anywhere, march anywhere, and they were, I don't know, but I would have thought about 3 stone, about 40 pounds. Very much dependent, of course, on distance. And some people were much stronger than others. I remember months back before this having had to relieve one of my signallers of a 21 set because the poor man just couldn't carry it any further. I don't remember seeing this manpack operation. I do remember the mules very well. Awkward brutes. I suppose it occurs to me for the first time in my life to wonder whether there was an army regulation covering the question you've asked, whether there was a maximum regulated manpack which would fall just short of hernia, I suppose, that sort of thing. No doubt somebody had looked into it.
It is quite a common thing in mountain operations. It was done in East Africa, for example.
Was it?
Eritrea and in Ethiopia that in some cases manpacking had to be organised as a way of supplying forward units.
I mean, one mustn't be heretical, but was it a case of white men organising black men to carry the stuff? Or?
Well, no, it was a case of, in some cases, about up to a third of a battalion being used as porters to resupply the other two-thirds.
Really? That's very interesting. I don't remember it taking quite this form, but I can see that it could. I can see that vehicles, 1,500 weight trucks or whatever, could take supplies up to the edge of a river where the bridge had been blown, and then stuff would be ferried over, and it would be the other side where you would have no vehicles and you have to start humping.
Yes.
Presumably the Falklands had, well, one heard about humping in the Falklands.
Well, it's mainly themselves, and they used cross-country vehicles, tracked vehicles, some of them designed for Arctic.
And presumably there were no rivers there worth mentioning.
No, not really, and helicopters, and the local Falkland Islanders used their own tractors and other vehicles to help.
Uh-huh.
But they did have to carry quite a lot of stuff with them for emergency purposes.
And this was all bedeviled by these numerous rivers going east to west across this Gothic Lion area. What I seem to remember is that our troops were not backward in depriving Italian farmers of their horses and carts for a while, rather than carry the stuff themselves.
Requisitioning,
yes, or just taking, yes.
Liberation, that
yes,
was called.
Yes, liberating horses and carts. I don't remember a great deal of mass organised man-pack carrying.
But if it has to be done over a sustained distance, quite often it's a matter of organising relays.
Mm. And yes.
And then going between
yes,
two points,
sure,
backwards
sure,
and forwards.
Sure. Yes.
Like a bucket chain in
yes,
a way.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
And you mentioned mules. Were these mules Italian mules? The Italian army is reputed
well, they
the
certainly
best.
Hadn't been brought out from England, but
no.
Yes, they were Italian mules. And what I don't know, and I wish I did, was the source of supply. Presumably it was the service corps who would lay this on. But there they were. I mean, mules appeared. We'd had them before in the hills around Cassino.
Yes.
I'd forgotten that we actually had them again in this Gothic Lion situation until reading this.
The Indian troops were quite accustomed to employing mules, especially if they'd been on the northwest frontier,
sure.
Where they were a normal
sure.
means of transport.
That's right. But we had them regardless of Indians, both in the Cassino area and I think again here. I don't think it was the fact that we were attached to the 10th Indian Division alone which produced mules. They were part of the regular emergency supply system. If bridges were blown, vehicles couldn't get across, then almost miraculously mules appeared. How they got them there, goodness knows, because they're obstinate beasts.
They could swim rivers.
That's true, they could.
And they would be swum across the rivers, and presumably some kind of raft or boat ferry would be employed to bring the goods up to the bank, and they would take them on from there. Did you ever see any mountain artillery? Because that was normally carried on mules, broken down into
yes, indeed
packs.
It was, that's right, broken down into barrel and all the rest, all the pieces, the wheels.
Yes.
The kind of thing you see displayed at the Royal Tournament. Now, did I see any in action, or have I just imagined that I may have seen it? What I'm trying to remember is whether by this stage we were already seeing the first of the Alpinieri, the Italian troops who came in to the war. This is a year after the surrender, and they had got organised and were being organised to help us. And I think they may have had some mountain artillery. We didn't have any, of course, ourselves, as a field regiment. And I don't know who would have had it.
Well, again, the Indian divisions would have had mountain regiments attached. 3.7-inch howitzer was the usual weapon for them.
Yes.
But the Italians certainly had mountain artillery.
Yes,
I think theirs was 65mm, something like that.
Uh-huh.
Rather small calibre and old-fashioned.
I think they may have been in action in small numbers by this time, because if it wasn't at this time, then it would be never, because once we got down onto the plains, they wouldn't have needed mountain artillery, and by the time we got beyond the Po, the war had finished.
Well, you certainly wouldn't have to employ Alpini down on the Po.
Well, exactly.
Do you have any clear recollection of what impression they made on you.
Well, the Alfinieri, yes. They were we thought they were very impressive. I mean, we had, as a, I was going to say as a race, that's a silly thing to say, but I mean, as sort of patriotic British formations of soldiers, etc., etc., we were almost professionally contemptuous from the time of the surrender of what the Italian army might be, particularly given the experiences of North Africa where there'd been huge taking of prisoners and so on. But when we encountered these Alfinieri with their very smart hats and knee breeches and so on, we were, and of course their adaptation to pidgin English, at least in talking to us, these were very bright cookies, and we quite obviously they were dedicated at least as much as we were to getting shot at the Germans. We didn't see much of them, but when we did, it was on a liaison basis. They'd come up and talk about the, you know, which targets or which areas of advance. And I think it was just the officers we saw, it would be. But yes, quite impressive.
So you did actually, do you remember actually shooting in support of them?
No, I don't. I don't remember it. But then they would have probably been a relatively small ingredient of a major allied unit of some kind. I mean, there might have been an odd company thrown in to help out with a battalion or something like that. But the contact was very oblique and very sparse, really, because they didn't have a part to play, I think, in joining in our bombardments as artillery. Sorry, my memory is very faulty at this point.
Now, you're also mentioning that you'd been supporting 10th Division, the Gurkhesen 10th Division, then 46th Division, and then 4th Division.
That's right.
And did this in any way impair your effectiveness? Because it's frequently said that one of the great strengths of the British Army in the Second World War was that there was the custom of having a battery normally attached to the same battalion on a permanent basis, which meant that they would get to know each other very well, they would have an instinctive rapport, so that response times of the artillery were very, very quick.
That's right, yes. I mean, that is perfectly true. I mean, the old boy basis was very clear, and the, you know, going for, in a lull, they'd be going for drinks in each other's messes, this kind of thing. The comradeship was very close, and I don't know, but it may even have preceded the war, you know, in the territorial.
I think in divisional structures, it, you know, it was something that was promoted as as a desirable practice.
I don't think this was done. This switching between the people we were supporting was done frivolously. Obviously, it wasn't. It was, and when you had been cut down, as the Gothic line had cut down our division from three brigades, was it to two? You have to make do, and this is what was happening. We were conscious of the need for flexibility. I don't think it caused any undue disruption in the way things happened. But then, of course, I was not a battery commander, and I was not dealing with an unfamiliar battalion commander, so I don't know what minor problems it may have caused, but in operational terms, I think they were not, they must have been minimal.
Of course, the cutting edge would have been the FOOs with company
commanders.
Yes,
that's right, it would. That's quite right.
That's where any problems that did occur would probably arise, most obviously. And,
particularly, perhaps, in the case of dealing with the Indian divisions, whose background may have been rather different.
Because they would have had their own custom and practice.
That's right. Yes. Their mores and battle handling may have been different. But one didn't hear, one was not conscious of anything going wrong for this sort of reason. And I think that my colonel at that time, with whom I was in obviously close contact, would have made his feelings known if things were slipping up for these reasons.
I think you were mentioning that you were attached 4th Division and that they were going to attack, was it Forley you mentioned?
Forley, yes. That's right. And, yes, now, that I was reading to you there a sort of summarised account of the sort of October's work and early November. Going back to my diaries, it may be... 1st of November, 44, things quietened down a bit. The battle is further away. The Gurkha 43rd Brigade is out of the line again, and we revert to the command of our own, quotes, our own 56th Division. Party in a billet with whiskey, vermouth, beer, two crazy Italian girls who were making eyes at the Nazis not so long ago.
That's a very cynical observation.
Yes.
Did you know that for a fact, or was that
No, it's just an unworthy suspicion. Assumption. If they hadn't been, one would have been puzzled.
That's a very dim view of young ladies.
People have to adapt. That's survival. It comes through there. 2nd, 3rd, guns now out of action, no duty officer needed.
What month would that be?
This was the 3rd of November, 44. Mm. And the we were billeted, the adjutant and I were billeted in this sort of village house of the Giunchi family, who I think were refugees from Bologna. And I noted sardonically that we were not very dangerous people, but Edda's mother refuses to leave her daughter's side. I don't blame her. And then I noted that the regiment was to stay here some time, pending its fate, its further dispositions. But little work and a dance was being arranged. We were obviously relaxing. We had a party in our billet with adjutant, signals officer, and one of the... troop commanders. Sunday the 5th of November, lovely autumn morning. Go along to mass with Edda. Take photos. Then she flirts with Ian. We're on this sort of basis now. We're obviously relaxing. Weather is better. Then bad news, our rest is cut short. We have to support an attack by 4th Division on our right, from a new gun area down on the plains. Ian, that's the adjutant, hears that his brigade major training posting is coming through. That will mean, if it happens, will mean a new adjutant. Monday the 6th November, send reconnaissance parties out. Sorry to be moving out of this comfortable billet. The CO is worse than ever, and there's sort of personalised morgue. Get ready to move and hand over a billet to 46th Division, play poker, and finish on a quiet note, a lovely week, enjoyable week. Tuesday the 7th of November, up at 5 o'clock, move 6:15 onto the plains near Forlimpopoli. Very noisy, presumably that was gunfire. The CO is fortunately called to HQRA of 4th Division for 48 hours. It's damp down here on the plains, busy working out fire plans. Back to the grindstone, gunnery and war. Living in a large farmhouse, of a stud farm, very kind, honest people, not many troops around, just a few shells.
go to HQRA for maps and have three quarters of an hour on the way back calling in on Edda's family. She gives me a letter for me to gives a letter for me to deliver to Ian. Thursday the 9th November, the general comes but tells us nothing about the future. There are, however, great rumours about the division being broken up and about the usual rumours about Greece, Burma, etc. Meanwhile, we hear that the Germans have